Noise and Notes, and I'm Philip Bailey. A report by the Bluegrass Institute shows the achievement gap along lines of race is actually wider in the east end of Louisville. I spoke with WFPL's Devin Katayama and former Metro Councilman Dr. Deontay Hollowell, who is a member of the Black Alliance for Educational Options, about the report's ramifications of the education debate.
I think the message is that perhaps we had it all wrong about West End education and East End education in regards to what it's doing for Black children. But I also don't. I think we have to look at this the correct way, and we have to understand what this is saying, because the Bluegrass Institute didn't necessarily delve into what this may mean, you know, really. They just laid the statistics out there and kind of leave it up to the reader to decide, well, how did this happen, or what exactly does this mean going forward? But I don't think that it means... I think that it means that there's still plenty of work to be done on both sides.
Because politically speaking, Bluegrass Institute is known as a conservative think tank, so they have a political bent, obviously. But the report does break some myths. I mean, the you know, speaking for the previous generations where it was, let's have diversity in schools, the student assignment plan, let's break segregation in Jefferson County schools, the idea was to send students into the schools where they had the most opportunity, and that being East End schools.
Right.
This report shows the opposite.
Right. And some of the surprises, and I think you were alluding to it a little bit, was the fact that African-American students in the East End don't perform as well as they perform in the West End. White students still perform as well in the West End schools as they do in the East End schools. And I shouldn't say there, because we don't really know with this report where the students are coming from exactly.
Right.
You know, there could be a handful of white students in the West End schools who are attending those schools. So we do have to think about that while we're taking a look at these numbers as well.
But for example, and this is from the Bluegrass Institute report, it says that the graduation rate for white students at Western High School, which is in West Louisville, is 34.8%. Blacks at the same school graduate at 66.4%. Now, the Bluegrass Institute says neither of those rates are that good.
Right. That was the one thing I was about to say. This it's still bad, horrible.
But the idea is that, well, the poor schools, the bad schools are in the West End. We need to export and exchange, not only for diversity reasons, but for achievement reasons, to send children into more affluent areas and more affluent schools. But they're not doing that well in those East End schools,
according
to the Bluegrass Institute report, which finds at Eastern High School, white graduation rate is about 82.8%. And for their black counterparts, it's 49.1%. And Eastern is considered a top high school, but for African-American students, it's not. It's considered a dropout factory.
Part of this report is the push for charter schools, essentially. And that's been a long-going debate the past year, especially with the charter legislation we had this past year that failed. But now this brings to question how to close this achievement gap. Is charter schools the only way to close this achievement gap? And I think with things that are changing in Jefferson County right now, statewide, nationwide as well, do you think that we need to give more time to some of the efforts that are being made for some of the low-achieving schools? The Project Proficiency, which has been an effort to kind of set up interventions for the lowest performing schools that have seemed to have some success so far. Do you think those are possibilities before we step into that charter discussion or charter realm?
I don't think one thing has to be a deterrent of the other, quite frankly. I think you have to do both. And I think that we have to really, really decide that education is of top priority. And we have to really, really realize that it affects every other facet of our lives here in Jefferson County. So my opinion would be that you would need to try to focus energies on doing both. But
are charter schools the answer?
No. I don't think charter schools is the answer. I think charter schools are one of many answers that could be looked at as something that would help our kids gain better educational options. I also believe that the charter schools legislation is what needs to be focused on. So we can only have great charter schools if we have great legislation.
Now, what do you think about districts of innovation? That was some legislation that was passed this past year. It wasn't charter legislation,
right,
but it left a lot of room for districts to be innovative, for districts to come to the state board of education and say, we want to try it this way. Can we do it this way? What's your thoughts about that? Because the legislation is kind of vague in the sense of what school districts are able to do.
I actually, you know, for what it's worth, I think that it's one of those things where they say, okay, we love the idea of what public charter schools are because this District of Innovations thing is very similar to what a charter school is or what a public charter school is. So it's one of those kind of ways of saying we like the ideas, but in my opinion, politically, we're not ready to give it up yet. And, you know, that's why I'm not a politician.
And to be honest,
anymore. You were for a brief period, but
I was a political leader.
I questioned JCPS earlier this year about the districts of innovation, they said they'd be interested in toying around with some ideas. Obviously, I mean, to see any huge drastic changes, I would be very surprised to see that.
But you do, I mean, there is an interesting political coalition when it comes to charter schools or education reform in any form in this state. You have African American Democrats, I think of Councilwoman Sherry Bryan Hamilton. And you have, you know, Bluegrass Institute, which is known as a very conservative organization, or conservative think tank, sort of agreeing that we need to do something. Because when you look at these achievement gaps, I mean, 5 years ago, a report came out that showed in Jefferson County, only 36% of African-American men, boys, were graduating from JCPS. I mean, that's abysmal, I think. I think it's fair to use that terminology for it. So when there's that sort of emergency behind it, that seems to be the part where we ignore it, where we talk about poverty, we talk about race, we talk about gender, but we don't talk about how they're mixed together. It seems to be a problem of African-American boys. A school like Central High School, for example, my alma mater, has majority African-American females. And even though they have high levels of free or reduced lunch, Central's test scores tend to do better than most schools or are in the top ranking high schools here in Jefferson County. At least in my theory, it's because it has more African-American females and less African-American boys. That appears to be the consistent thing over and over again. Not poverty, not even race, but a specific demographic of African-American boys.
I would say that some of that is true. Some of that would definitely be reflected in some of the data that you would see regarding gender and education, especially amongst black folks. But I would venture to say that still the current educational practices are not benefiting our kids at large. And, of course, you will single out African-American males as being the ones who would probably be most detrimented by that. But I don't think that they're the only ones that are hit by it.
Now, we know that there is, I mean, I've been a solid support in this community for the student assignment plan as it stands now. Mm-hmm. There would be those, Deontay, who would say, listen, the Bluegrass Institute is a conservative organization that has an agenda to dismantle student assignment plan. I guess, how do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, you never see me supporting any student assignment plan. But, I mean, others in the African-American community certainly have. And I think that this coalition also between the Bluegrass Institute and, I guess, the Democrats, I would say is only with Sherry. I don't think any of the other African-American Democrats are.
Yeah, the only other African-American Democratic elected official I've heard even show some sympathy for it was Reginald Meeks when he said we should at least have the conversation.
Right.
He didn't really throw his support behind it, but he said, State Representative Reginald Meeks said that we should at least have the conversation about
right.
charter schools.
And for what it's worth, we've had conversation with some of the others, and they're willing to talk about it to a certain degree, but I don't think it's one thing that they want to focus on, per se. But in the black community, what we did at Bayo later in 2011, was we went out and we just started actually talking to the people. We went to Kroger on 34th, and we went to the other Kroger in West Louisville, and we just started asking people if they wanted educational change, and we started breaking down what it meant to have public charter schools as an option in Jefferson County. And people were very interested, and we had over 10,000 signatures just in West Louisville.
Devin, is that, in your reporting, do you see a higher level of people saying, I'm not necessarily against the student assignment plan in diversity, but I'm not satisfied with the level of education that I'm seeing in my community, whether it's my child specifically or the children in my community.
Yeah, and that's actually not just a Jefferson County issue. That's an issue nationwide that people are trying to figure out what the heck to do with this education system. I mean, there are so many different programs, so many different ways to teach students, and they're all, and some are really successful in little pockets. Then you go to another state, you go to another county, that might not be successful over there. So it's really hard to determine. And there's reflecting data on charter schools too, which just throws another wrench into the whole idea. But that's definitely something here in Jefferson County that's kind of highlighted, because we do have programs that when you ask district leaders, like their career and technical schools, that these are kind of more innovative programs, not necessarily charter at all, but programs that are trying to unlock that door in a child's mind to have them think about education in a different way. And so that's the question. And charter schools, you know, for a lot of people, that is a key, because that will basically shake up the whole thing and let people kind of do what they think they need to do to educate kids.
Deonte Hallowell, Devin Katayama, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Devin stuck around to join a political roundtable of Leo Weekly's Joe Sanka, Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston, and Louisville blogger Curtis Morrison. We talked about the Metro Council's contentious landmarks ordinance and the establishment line of succession in state politics. Let me just start by asking about the landmarks ordinance. Kurt, let me start with you. Are you satisfied with what happened?
No, I'm not satisfied. Of course, it's not over, but I don't think that it should have ever got this far. There's just not the support in the community to even change the ordinance the way it is now.
Because in the beginning, when we saw these open forums, open meetings, those who are against the amendment outnumbered those who were in favor of it, like 10 to 1.
Yeah, 6 to 1. Yeah. Really. Yeah.
So you begin to wonder, where did this come from initially? But like I said, we're past that point. Devin, what happened this week?
This week they made some changes yet again. I think it was the seventh version of the landmarks ordinance. And essentially they passed it out of committee. They passed it out of the landmarks and zoning, or the planning and zoning committee. A 3-2 vote, and now essentially there is the provisions that's been in there all along, essentially giving more weight. 101 of the 200 petition signatures that are needed need to come from residents either living within a 1-mile radius of the site or within the council district where the proposed landmarks
now,
site is.
When you were at the committee meeting, I thought it was interesting. Yates alluded to the potential for corruption on the Landmarks Commission. Am I correct in that was his assessment, essentially one of his arguments for why he's making these changes?
Right.
I thought that was rather interesting, because don't we have a committee on Metro Council that reviews appointments to boards and commissions? Isn't it the Appointments Committee, and isn't Councilman Yates a member of that committee?
Yeah. I mean,
what's this supposed corruption that's happening?
The supposed corruption is if the Landmarks Commission makes a decision based on whatever. They just make a decision because they want something landmarked, because maybe it has a really big historic value. Maybe there's not a historic value to a majority of people, but they make the decision. There's just nobody overseeing that decision.
Is that corruption?
It's not corruption, but if the appointed body somehow becomes corrupt or somehow makes a bad decision in the sense
So this is a solution looking for a problem. Is that what this is?
You could say that, there's really very small instances where there might be corrupt. I mean, these are very small, mathematical equations that would have to work out. A lot of variables have to come into play for this to even get as far to the proposed ordinance that we saw pass out of committee this week.
Kurt, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's kind of an impossibility, but let's not forget, I mean, the Metro Council is the one that the appointments meeting was yesterday for the committee that he is on, like you said. So it's not like the Metro Council doesn't have control over the appointments, too. I mean, yes, the mayor makes them, but the Metro Council has to approve them.
Joe, what's been Leo's take on this landmarks ordinance? It has, because we've seen this before on the Metro Council, where there's these disagreements and we have this long, drawn-out argument over legislation that sometimes can get very complicated. Is this a legitimate point here, or is this maybe a bit of exaggeration on Councilman Yates' part?
Well, I think this all stems from Colonial Gardens, and they don't want to have another Colonial Gardens situation where something receives a historic landmark designation, and people in that community are upset with it. But it's going to be interesting to see if this two-thirds majority that's needed to for the council to overturn the designation. Whether that stays into the legislation next Thursday when they vote for it,
or it's just a simple majority that can vote it in.
Yeah, instead of a simple majority, a supermajority.
And I believe it's a supermajority just to bring up the issue, yeah. And then a majority to actually make the decision. Which, I mean, that's interesting how that would work out too.
Right. Yeah, but this is definitely. I've been to plenty of meetings, including the public meetings where people give input, and it's obvious that Councilman Yates and Councilman Owen have gotten into some heated discussions even after meetings. So this is something that they both obviously care a great deal about, and it looks like the long road that this has taken is probably going to be decided this Thursday.
And Devin, this has made you even cynical a little bit. I mean,
I have been following this for a long time. I can't tell you how many different ways I've tried to write the number of petitions or the number of signatures that you need to get, the 101 signatures coming from the different areas that they've mentioned throughout the past few months. But the one thing that I have to say is, and council members from both sides have said this throughout the process, is that the process has been... There's been a lot of discussion on the issue, whether or not they're taking a lot of public input on the discussion. It has been a very democratic-like process. And they don't say that about everything that they do, but they felt like this was one instance that whether there's huge disagreements, which there are, it will be decided in a very democratic way and fairly.
Cool.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if this does pass Thursday and there is a controversial landmarks designation, whether people are going to lobby the council to get votes. I mean,
We're a political body. Because it's ironic that the one place where someone has been removed for questionable ethical behavior has been the Metro Council, and now the council's pointing fingers at other boards and commissions and saying, well, there's this potential for corruption here that we haven't seen in the past, but it could potentially happen. Let's switch this to some broader political topics that have gone on. Some interesting things have happened in Kentucky as of late. Kenny, Congressman Ben Chandler, is he going to the Democratic National Convention?
No, he is not going to the Democratic National Convention.
Why not?
Well, he says he has a busy schedule in his district, but I think a lot of people think that he's doing what other Democrats are doing and is distancing himself from President Obama in his election year. I mean, he's up for re-election again as a congressman every 2 years. He's got the same challenger, Andy Barr.
But I thought, and correct me if I'm wrong, when you were on this program earlier this year, and Joe, I think we've talked about this, didn't the redistricting favor Chandler in the sense that we have more Democrats? I mean, Joe, you're from Lexington.
Yes.
You are familiar with Congressman Chandler.
I'm quite familiar.
If he's more comfortable and has more Democrats in his district, why still run away from the president?
I think he wants to run up the score a little bit, so because right now he's seen as so vulnerable because he won by such a small margin.
Because he beat Barr by what, like
it was a few hundred votes, and I think redistricting has obviously helped him a great deal. But Chandler continuing to distance himself from the president, besides Obamacare and Wall Street reform and the EPA and everything else that he's voted against the president with. Over the last 2 years.
But is it that serious to where you don't go to the convention? I mean,
yeah, I think the expectation was all of the so-called superdelegates, they're not called that anymore, but all the Democratic elected officials were going to attend.
Governor Beshear is going.
He is going. But of course, as we've seen, he's not up for re-election. He's kind of embraced the president this week, meeting him at Cincinnati, embracing a lot of his proposals now. I think Chandler's just being safe. I don't think there's a real fear of Andy Barr this year because of some of the redistricting. But I think, why give Barr a chance to tie me to the president is basically what he's doing. Why give an opportunity for me to stand up as an Obama delegate?
And no one's ever accused Congressman Chandler of having political courage. So this is pretty much in line, and I'm not really shocked at all that he would take a skip on the convention.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. I mean, I was a bit surprised only in the sense that it drew attention to him that he may not have wanted. But Kenny, your reporting obviously pulled that scab off.
Thanks.
Now, we've seen some different reports now. Senator Mitch McConnell, raising more and more money for his reelection bid. Everyone's still speculating who's going to run on the Democratic side. He faced a Republican challenger. We now know that there is at least one big name Democrat who is off the list. No more putting this person's name in the speculation columns or anything like that. Kenny, who's that?
That would be former auditor Crit Llewellyn. She was kind of considered the, I guess, the big get because of her two terms as auditor, how she kind of elevated that office.
She was sort of the dream candidate for Democrats, right?
Yeah, exactly. I think her only two things that people were worried about would possibly be fundraising against McConnell, which is a concern for most Democrats. And second of all, there were some issues in the past with her husband. But those seem like relatively small issues when you look at the rest of the Democratic candidates.
Is this disappointing? I mean, at the end of the day, this was the dream ticket that a lot of Democrats were talking about. Someone who had enough, I guess, stature in Democratic politics, who's a veteran of Kentucky politics, enough, someone who wasn't too young and the right sort of stature. Is this deflate those who are the Ditch Mitch crowd that's always there every 6 years? Are they a bit deflated by this decision by Llewellyn not to run?
I think they were hoping Crit Llewellyn was going to be the candidate that had the best chance, and she certainly did. And right now, you look at the Democratic field, and you're kind of scratching your head as who would be the candidate that could actually beat Mitch
McConnell. Is it the past or your future? You have some people saying Governor Beshear could do it, even though he's a bit old, and he might want to just walk off into the sunset with his two gubernatorial victories.
Or he may want that rematch from the 96 race.
And to get rid of the Beshear'd verb out there.
Exactly.
Or you just get trounced.
Yeah, so you could have the old guard, you could have Beshear, you know, jumping back out of retirement and taking on Mitch McConnell, or you could look at the younger crowd of Kentucky Democrats, and you could look at Allison Lundergan Grimes or Adam Edlin. And I think both of those candidates would definitely have a tough road ahead jumping into an opponent like Mitch McConnell.
I wouldn't mind Joni Jenkins.
Is Joni Jenkins interested at all?
Oh, we could talk her into it if maybe somebody would talk about her. But instead,
who's the we here that would talk Joni Jenkins and leaving her perch, a nice little carved out perch as a lawmaker, into a suicide mission to run for governor?
I don't think it'd be a suicide mission. I think she's.
How many votes do you think she'd get in the Democratic primary?
I don't count votes. I don't know.
You ran for office.
Well, first of all, it'd be a crowded primary because you've got all these people that they've mentioned that think that they're entitled to it, and Joni doesn't, and we need somebody that doesn't think they're entitled to it.
Curtis Morrison, Joe Sanka, Kenny Colston, David Katayama, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
His pockets, and she wreck his days, and she make him love her, then she shoot fly away. She got a black dress on for $1,000.
Noise and Notes on WFPL is produced by me, Philip Bailey, with Joe Durso. For more, visit WFPL.org.